Well, disaster for America, as once again Gary Johnson fails in his bid to become US president. If you're listening to this episode, we assume that you're looking for a wry, sideways look at the catastrophe in which we now find ourselves.
Yeah, so listeners, what you may have seen over the few days in the run-up to the election was that on our website, we put up a prediction. Now, in our defence, we did actually get most of the states right.
45 out of 50 states correct.
Yeah, we did.
Only problem is the five we didn't get were Florida, Minnesota, Michigan, Pennsylvania and New Hampshire. Yeah. Turns out they're five quite important states.
It turns out it is quite right. But perhaps the most important thing is this. Who authored that piece, Corey?
That was me, obviously. We're at 90% success rate.
Yeah, 90%. There. But what the listeners probably do need to be aware of is this simple fact. Corey is cursed. He has never really supported a candidate which has won a campaign. His overall success rate in supporting winning campaigns stands at about 5%.
I think it's as high as that, actually.
dear listeners, if you want someone to blame for the fact that the Trumpocalypse is now upon us, I would suggest you start with Corey, because he has managed to truly doom us all.
But in this episode, we're going to see who else apart from me is to blame. So we've got Steve Haynes, my partner in propaganda, you've already heard. We also have an actual politician. We've got Councillor Bridget Jones. Hello, Bridget.
Hello. I'm starting to question why I've decided to come on the show, given your success rate. I feel I ought to disassociate myself from you and get the hell away from you so I can win some elections in the future.
Professional politicians, eh?
So what we're going to talk about, we're going to talk about three things. We're going to talk about the popularity of Donald Trump. We are going to talk about the failings of Hillary Clinton and the Democrats. And then we're going to answer the question that you're all silently asking yourselves, which is there going to be a nuclear war in which we all die? Although I didn't predict Donald Trump's win, someone who did, and someone who called it quite early 5 months ago, is Michael Moore. The five reasons he gives, first of all, what he called the Rust Belt Brexit. So the fact that places like Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, that communities there completely screwed over by NAFTA in the 90s, and they were going to turn out for Trump, which is kind of what happened. Also talks about the last stand of the angry white man. Talks about the Hillary problem, the depressed Sanders vote, the fact that people who voted for Sanders didn't necessarily then vote for Clinton, and what he called the Jesse Ventura effect, which I'm afraid is a popular culture reference I don't really understand.
Would you like me to explain then?
Very, very briefly.
Jesse Ventura was a professional wrestler who became the governor of, I want to say it was somewhere like Minnesota. He ran as an independent candidate and basically was able to win by virtue of the whole stick it to the man.
So it's kind of, so the Jesse Ventura effect is basically sticking it to the system.
Through voting for a celebrity.
Okay. I think if you put those first three together though, the kind of the Rust Belt, the angry white men and the Hillary problem, and about the women problem, how much is it just the triumph of racism, the triumph of misogyny?
I'm interested in the angry white woman problem as well. So Trump, to my shock, won amongst white women too. And I've been trying to figure through why, you know, as a fellow white woman, somebody might choose to vote for him. And one of my theories about the whole misogyny, racism thing, is it's become so normal, people don't bat an eyelid at it anymore.
The fact that he won the most women votes, I think, is interesting. I think partly it comes on education lines as well, and we've kind of talked about that in Brexit, as how education, or lack of the lesser educated you were, the more likely you were to vote for Brexit. It's the same with the women as well.
That is the case to a certain extent. Certainly there was a lower propensity to vote for Trump among white women, or just white people in general with college degrees. The reality is both of those subgroupings still broke, you know, for Trump. So it's not just down to just down to the education level. The entirety of this election, ever since the that Access Hollywood tape broke, was working on the assumption that Hillary Clinton was going to walk the white woman's vote. Why would they ever support someone who brags about that sort of stuff? I don't think this is about internalised misogyny. These aren't white women who hate themselves or anything like that. It's potentially a statement about what they think about, what they expect from men, though. When you consider, for instance, that an awful lot of the people, or an awful lot of the women who did vote for Trump are probably dealing in contact with a lot of Trump supporters, and the kind of the cultural divides that you have between Trump supporters and Hillary supporters and Democrats and Republicans and the rural kind of population and the urban one. It's entirely possible that the notion that it's just locker room talk, it resonates more strongly with them than it does, you know, the urban liberal side of the population, because, you know, that isn't locker room talk. I mean, you know, I'm sure we've all been, like, both me and Corey have been in various locker rooms over the years, and...
Speak for yourself, yeah. Steve. I'll keep my away from
them. Good to know, guys.
Yeah, and we've never kind of, like, experienced or heard anything like that.
I'd say it's normal in all swathes of society. The difference is how outraged we are by it. So if you look at the charts, look at songs like the Robin Thicke one that caused a lot of controversy. Actually, that song was no worse than half the other things in the charts at that time. Mm. The videos about and the way they portray women, not that different. Look at any films. Look at the Bechdel test and how many films fail that. Look at any advertising hoarding and, you know, the gender depictions there. A lot of this stuff is so normal, it just fades into the background. And people don't pick up, as Donald Trump saying, some of this stuff is particularly odd, because people are talking on the radio about grabbing women by the pussy all the time. And, you know, in films, that kind of behaviour is normalised. It's just a question of how outraged you are by it. And, yeah, your urban elites probably are more outraged by it than people who have bigger things to worry about, like their bank balance and their kids.
Mm. And the Guardian's done some quite good journalism talking to Trump voters in the Rust Belt, so places like Youngstown, Ohio, like those kind of places. And the consensus you seem to get amongst kind of Trump voters of both genders, really, is that, yes, Trump is a flawed candidate. They would have rather have voted for someone like Ted Cruz, say, or John Kasich.
The notion of Cruz not as a flawed candidate as
entertaining.
to go with it. But despite the fact they see him as a flawed candidate, they decide that actually his positives outweigh the negatives, and the fact that he's talking about getting rid of free trade deals, the fact he's talking about ripping up NAFTA, the fact that in states, I'm pretty sure it's states like Michigan, he's talking about reopening coal mines, which kind of appeals to depressed mining communities there. He's probably the first candidate to talk about that in probably ever. That's seen as more important than any kind of issues about misogyny.
Yeah, or racism or whatever, which in and of itself is kind of worrying, because at the end of the day, if you're not viewing racism as a very important issue, if you're not viewing like misogyny as an important issue, then heaven help us. But
is it also that one of the best quotes I've seen since the election was actually written by Glenn Beck, who appears to have reinvented himself as the voice of sanity in... No, honestly, disturbing thing this week is an article where he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times and said that the people who were against Trump took him literally but not seriously, and his supporters took him seriously but not literally. So all of Trump's outrageous statements, they just saw it as part of his kind of easygoing, folksy, straightforward charm. And one of the more disturbing things I saw, it was on John Dickerson mentioned it on the Slate Gabfest, is apparently the voters saw Trump as being more trustworthy than Clinton was. And it's almost this idea of, well, he tells it like it is, whereas Clinton was seen as this kind of very...
Clinton kept on doing things which conform to an existing narrative around her and around Bill, that they are very secretive individuals, that they're not very transparent, which is very true. It is, you know, pretty much an accurate statement to say that the Clintons are not the most transparent individuals in the world. And then you have email scandals and then deleting emails and having physical printouts of them, but not necessarily... But after having deleted them too, so it just all ends up kind of...
It didn't look the best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you have all the random things like Bill Clinton getting on a plane with the Attorney General of the USA whilst Hillary Clinton is being investigated by the FBI. And it all feeds into this notion of secrecy and that they are a part of this political elite that can get away with things that other people wouldn't do. I've said before that the only time really kind of narrative events and or events in a campaign matter is when they support an existing narrative about you. So the fact that Hillary Clinton has always been viewed as slightly untrustworthy, and then she did a lot of things which fit that narrative, it was always going to be a problem for her.
Okay, so how important was this FBI letter then from James Comey?
I think it was devastating. I couldn't have timed it worse. So if you think, one third of votes were cast early.
Mm.
So, and those people didn't have a chance in the main to go back and change their vote once she was exonerated. And people make their minds up before Election Day, a lot of people. So a lot of people will have seen that, decided it was the final straw, and stuck with that narrative. They'd have had that untrustworthy narrative in their head for longer than that last-minute reprieve that came through at the last minute. To me, it couldn't have been timed worse.
Yeah, I'd stand by that as well. I think, to be honest, that that Comey probably did cost Hillary Clinton the election. If it had happened 2 weeks earlier, or even a week earlier, there might have just been enough time to switch the narrative around again. Because basically, whenever the emails had come up as an issue in the campaign before that, you know, you'd always see Trump rise up in the polls and Clinton dip down again. But then something else would happen. Trump would say something daft, or, you know, the focus would shift onto something else as the media cycle moved on, and then Clinton would rise up again. If there'd been another week of campaigning, you may very well be looking at President Clinton right now, just because of the margin of Trump's victory in those five states we listed earlier was so narrow. It was something like 100,000 votes, I think.
So in
shift the election.
Yeah, so in Florida, Trump won by 200,000 votes out of 10 million cast. In Pennsylvania, he won by 60,000 out of 5 million cast. In Michigan, it was only 12,000 vote majority out of 4.5 million. In Wisconsin, it's 30,000 votes out of 3 million cast. So it's very small margins. So the reason Clinton won the popular vote is because she's stacked up big majorities in places like New York and California, where, you know, you don't count the Democratic votes, you weigh them.
One of the things that I saw from some analysis online was that, I can't remember which state, I think it might have been Michigan, but it could have been one of the others, basically said Clinton needed, you know, however many votes it was, let's call it 50,000, say, to win the state. And there were 100,000 ballots which didn't have president filled in. Without that Comey letter, it's entirely possible that those people walked into that booth feeling much more positive about Clinton, end up voting for her. And that holds for Republicans who are looking potentially to switch. It holds for Democrat kind of Bernie Sanders supporters, and even potentially people who ended up voting for Jill Stein and Gary Johnson. If those votes have been slightly lower in those states, you know, we'd be having a very different podcast right now.
Well, that's the thing, because despite that, Clinton won by a bigger victory than Nixon did in 68, and by a bigger victory than JFK did over Nixon in 1960.
Yeah, in terms of the popular vote.
Yeah, in terms of the popular vote, but how do you design an electoral college system in a two-horse race?
The electoral college system has done exactly what it was designed to do by the founding fathers. It was built and designed so that people who lived in the rural states where there wasn't as many people would still have their opinions listened to. Unfortunately, in this instance, it doing its job meant that the Trump got in. Now, you can argue that maybe the electoral college is a bit daft in the 21st century. And, you know, I'd say there's a strong case to be made for that. But ironically, this is a classic example, potentially, of the Constitution doing its job. We just need to kind of hope that the rest of that.
I don't think we're going to lead with that quote.
But there are so many other examples of how the system is skewed in unofficial ways well. So you're a third of black men in some areas who can't vote because they have a felony.
Yeah, this is the first election where the Voter Rights Act has been repealed. Yeah. Because, and here's the hilarious thing, they didn't need it anymore. And lo and behold, suddenly North Carolina ends up with a load of voter suppression activities going on where in 2012, 2008 and 2012, you had counties which had, you know, 60 polling places. They've now down to 10.
But something that really struck me watching the news footage was how hard it is to vote in America. So the queues at those polling stations were extraordinary.
There's some queuing for 4 or 5 hours, weren't they, for voting?
I've been a candidate 4 times. I've been to a lot of polling stations on polling day. Most days, you just waltz in and you're the only person in there. Yeah. It's very rare you actually queue in the UK. It's very, very easy to get out there and vote. But in America, it's not. You have to take half a day off work in some areas, or you have to put in the effort. You can understand why their turnout plummets in some areas, especially where people don't feel like it's going to matter.
Yeah, and this is, I think, one of the reasons why you've got a number of states they vote exclusively by mail-in ballot now. And you've got other states like Nevada, which are more or less exclusive early voting. You know, you can vote basically from any point from between a month to election day itself. That's really quite useful in some areas, certainly for any kind of candidates or parties with a good get-out-the-vote operation. Nevada has become a solid blue as a result of Harry Reid's work to get the Latino and working class vote.
Can we talk about that famed get-out-the-vote operation? Because when we alluded to in the introduction to my 90% wonderful prediction, but I mean, part of the reason why one assumes that states like Florida would go Clinton's way rather than Trump, even though Florida all the way through was pretty close, it was kind of 50-50 most of the way through, but one assumed that the famed Clinton ground game would manage to turn out people like women voters, Hispanic voters, Democrats that she needed. That doesn't appear to have happened. In fact, looking at the exit polls, Trump turned out more Republicans on his side than Clinton did on her side. So Trump got 90% of registered Republicans, Clinton only got 89% of registered Democrats. And that doesn't sound like a big margin, but they're the kind of margins that probably decide these states. I've seen it compared to the 2015 election here, where Labour had a kind of famed get-out-the-vote operation and talked about how they'd had something like 7 million voter contacts and that kind of thing. But in the end, that get-out-the-vote operation didn't matter because they had an unattractive candidate with an unattractive stone, with unattractive policies written on said stone. And I wonder if that's, as that happened with the Democrats, should we pivot to Hillary?
I think that's exactly what happened. So go back to Michael Moore's angry white men point. They were angry, and anger gets you up and it gets you out to vote. Yeah, it gives you that advantage. Meh doesn't get you out to vote. Thinking meh about a candidate makes you less likely to go.
Yeah, I think the other point to raise about Clinton's get out of the vote was it actually worked very, very well in a load of areas. I mean, as I say, Nevada. Same actually is the case for Florida, especially in areas where they had Hispanic low propensity voters actually turning out more or less for the first time ever. The issue in Florida was that Marco Rubio also has a very good get out of the vote operation. But the other thing is, the get-out-of-the-vote operation worked. They just didn't do it in the right place. In the last couple of weeks of the campaign, they got so cocky. They were looking at the map and kind of going, right, we're winning this, so let's expand the map. And so we're going to go to Arizona. We're going to go into North Carolina. We're going to go into, I think they even went down to Texas. It was just like, okay. Like, all of these things make sense from the perspective of, okay, we want to try and flip these in future elections. Demographically, these are going to be in our favour in the next 4, 8, 12 years. Makes total sense. The problem is they then invested their time and probably not too many resources in those, rather than buffering their firewall states, which are the Rust Belt states that Clinton lost.
So is a better British parallel maybe Cleggmania in 2010 then, when after Nick Clegg's debate performance, the Lib Dems saw in the polls, and that means rather than try and target their key kind of 60, 70 seats, they try and expand to places they wouldn't usually win and spread themselves too thinly.
That's a very good example. Like with Cleggmania in the 2010 election, basically a call to arms went out to get everybody down into Birmingham Hall Green constituency because we felt that we might actually be able to win it. Well, that was lost, but very badly. I think we ended up coming third overall, coming behind both Labour and the Respect candidate. More time and energy should have been put in other areas. So I do think there's a kind of a strong similarity there. And basically, I think it boils down to that John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, got cocky.
So I'm very impressed we managed to mention Hall Green in an American election podcast. So local reference to Birmingham, tick. We've talked a little bit about Hillary the candidate. Would Bernie Sanders have done better? Would Joe Biden have done better?
Well, other than Sanders and Biden, I'm trying to remember if anyone else was actually standing.
Martin O'Malley was the other guy who actually stood properly for about two states in the primary process.
Yeah, the Republican field was massive.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons I think Trump got through, wasn't it? That
yeah.
maybe one of the reasons why Trump got the nomination is almost because there were 16 of them and they're all trying to look presidential by... They thought they'd try and take down the proper candidates and then didn't really take on Trump until it was too late.
Yeah, allowing him to win a ton of states on like 35% of the vote. If it had just been Trump versus Cruz or Trump versus Kasich or Trump versus Rubio, it would have been no contest. And, you know, the more traditional candidate would have won the primary in all likelihood. For the Democrats, I just don't think they've got the talent because they don't have a very deep talent pool at all. I can think of a couple of individuals who maybe end up running for it. You've got Tim Kaine, obviously, as the vice presidential pick, but...
He's useless and boring.
But then...
VP debate, he
was
terrible.
Quite attractive right now.
Yeah, but potentially, yeah, after Trump. 4 years of Trump, maybe that's what America wants.
Maybe.
But who knows? So, mate, you've got Tim Kaine, you've got Cory Booker, who's the senator from New Jersey. In my opinion, a poor man's Barack Obama. He's trying very much to portray himself as the next Barack Obama, but he's not got the charisma. Other than that, Elizabeth Warren, maybe. Bernie Sanders runs again.
But won't he be about 203 by the time of the next election?
Exactly. So there's not a lot really going on, and that's symptomatic all the way through all the different kind of levels of government for the Democrats. If you look at the state legislatures, they've not been paying much attention. Ever since they got Barack Obama elected in 2008, they've basically gone, right, we've got the White House, we don't need to try anymore. Mm. Did you not learn anything from Howard Dean? You win elections by building up from the ground.
It feels weird. They've won the popular vote in the past 6 out of 7 elections, and yet they're probably the most screwed they've been, the Democrats, in about 100 years.
What you have in America is such an inaccessible system to get involved in. So I've always believed in Britain, anybody can become a councillor, it's free, you don't need a deposit, anyone can become an MP, actually. You know, it's much easier to get involved in the system and to become a candidate and to run. Harder to win, but, you know, running is accessible to most people. In America, it's a completely different ballgame. You need money.
Mm-hmm.
You need an awful lot of money to get to any serious position. And your field of people with that kind of money is obviously limited. That limits your candidates, essentially. Your filter up just isn't there. You have a very extreme filter.
Do we think Bernie would have won? Would he have beaten Trump?
No.
I don't think he would have won, I think there's probably at least a case to be made that he might have done better in those Rust Belt states. A number of the areas which basically won the election for Trump are areas which did vote for Barack Obama previously. And the reason that they're now voting Republican is down to economic issues in their areas, the fact that trade has killed off, and I'm using air quotes, around all of that, has killed off the jobs in those areas and all of that kind of stuff. And when you compare Bernie Sanders' message and Trump's message on those fronts, they're very, very similar. So maybe Bernie would have been able to hold on to some of those people a bit more effectively. However, Bernie comes with more baggage in other areas, so maybe he's not able to bring in even a number of the moderate Republicans that did switch. You know, it's all counterfactual, really. It's kind of a pointless debate.
We specialise, surely, on this podcast in pointless debates. But surely an election which is kind of dominated by Trump and misogyny and hate speech, and I just cannot see people in the Rust Belt being won over by promises to break up the big banks and to have a fully socialised healthcare system. I just don't see that playing in Youngstown, Ohio.
I think maybe we're overthinking this. I mean, Rust is orange and Trump is orange.
They see one of their own.
Trump personifies the Rust Belt. Okay,
think that might be my favourite hot take of the election so far.
Let's go with that. Shall we move on to whether or not we're all going to die?
Yeah, that's a good topic.
I think the scary thing...
Out the alcohol.
The scary thing...
Yeah, top us up.
About this election is, it's impossible to know how Trump is going to govern as president, because no one really knows what he thinks or believes about anything, because his views have changed constantly over the past 20, 30 years. And so it's perfectly possible that he will drop all this kind of hateful fascist rhetoric and govern a bit like Arnie or a bit like Reagan as some sort of floppy moderate Republican. However, it's also quite possible he's baited by Putin in a Twitter war and nukes someone. I honestly don't know what's going to happen, and that scares me a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's actually the real kind of terrifying thing for me, is that if it had been Rubio that had won, that was now going to be president, or Cruz even, or Kasich, or whoever else.
And if Donald Trump had bigger hands, Rubio would be president. But
yeah, yeah.
It's hard to tweet with big hands.
But yeah, if it was any of the other...
are so small.
If it was any of the other Republican field, we would know what to expect. Now, in some ways, Trump's going to be a pretty standard Republican in terms of tax cuts and all of that stuff for the rich. But the rest of it is really up in the air. Now, there are a number of things, actually, which if you're kind of a progressive individual, you can actually look at parts of what Trump's seemingly planning to do and be like, I'm actually all right with that, as weird as that sounds. So he's basically put an end to the Republicans' deficit hawkery. He's planning $1 trillion investment, $1 trillion worth of investment and tax cuts, primarily going into infrastructure for the US, the exact sort of thing that you should be doing to counter, economic decline. It's basic Keynesian economics.
I can't wait to see Paul Ryan try and push that through Congress.
I know, it's going to be amazing. Does he stick with that? Or does he become a deficit hawk because that's what Paul Ryan's going to only, the only thing that Ryan's going to be able to get through the House? Does he stick with building the wall and making Mexico pay for it? Or it appears to be already rolling back on that, with Newt Gingrich saying that the whole Mexico's going to pay for it was a campaigning device. But yeah, so looking carefully at the transition team that he's building is going to be actually be very, very interesting, especially as who he puts in the different positions. Chris Christie has been thrown out as the head of the transition team, and Mike Pence, his VP, has been brought in. Now, Pence is, in my opinion, a vile individual for many, many reasons. But in a lot of ways, he's a solid traditional Republican. And that means he's probably going to end up kind of pushing for relatively solid traditional Republican people, rather than bringing in Steve O'Bannon and the Breitbart alt-right types, which is better for America and means you're not going to have, Muslims being rounded up to send off to camps or anything like that, which is a genuine freaking risk if you have someone like Steve O'Bannon kind of running it.
Corey, you mentioned he's flip-flopped on his views in the last 20 to 30 years. We've seen him do it in the last 2 to 3 days. So the Trump we're seeing right now is quite a different Trump to the one we saw literally 4 days ago. Hillary is no longer the nasty, nasty woman. She was a good opponent.
A strong and respected candidate.
Yes.
Yeah, but Barack Obama is now a very good president who...
Born in America.
Definitely born in America, and Donald Trump is going to seek him out for counsel moving forward.
Yeah, and Obamacare is maybe okay. Only some bits of it, like the key bits of it, are kind of okay. So there's a big question mark over what we'll see. But if you look at his lack of political experience interests me. So, historically, he's been the head of a company. And if he wants something done, he tells somebody to do it and they do it. The presidency doesn't quite work like that. You've got to work with all the other bits of the political machine in order to achieve anything, as Barack Obama knows only too well. I wonder if his lack of knowledge and lack of understanding of how, or lack maybe of appreciation of how difficult some of that stuff would be, will come unstuck.
Businessmen in politics is an interesting one. I mean, we've seen a few business figures in politics here who get appointed as working peers, people like Alan Sugar are kind of good examples, and they drop out of politics pretty quickly. The problem that populist politics meeting electoral reality has, I suppose, is that you come in with your big fancy promises and then reality sets in. There's a really, really interesting New York Magazine piece which was written a few weeks before the end of the campaign about inside the Trump campaign. And one of the things when there was a complete car crash, it looked like he'd lose by double digits, and his campaign team asking, well, what is it that you want to do? You're obviously not enjoying this campaign. What is it you would like to do? And Trump says, well, I want to go out. I like doing the rallies. I like doing the speeches. I like the applause. And you kind of get the impression that he's a little bit of a narcissist and just wants the adulation. And
a
just,
little bit?
You're then president, and you have to make the tough choices, and your political reality hits. What happens to Trump supporters?
Our best case scenario, you know, for us as human beings, is he doesn't deliver on any of it. But what that then does for confidence in the American political system could be disastrous.
Absolutely. Like populist uprisings, when they succeed, become the system, become the establishment, and then the people that they were rode up on push them up to the top. Still don't see that much changing, because change is really, really difficult, or really, really slow normally. And as a result, they get pissed off and move on to the next, you know, radical uprising. And it ends up getting more extreme and more extreme and more extreme.
So we might not get nuclear war in the next 4 years, just maybe 8-12 years down the line.
Well, this is where I'm worried. So one of the reasons we're a little bit insulated from Trump is the Founding Fathers sewed this up quite neatly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite hard to do stuff in American politics as the president.
Yeah.
Trouble is, the Founding Fathers didn't have nukes to worry about. And they didn't really sew up the using nukes thing as neatly as they sewed up everything else.
Yeah.
The president can just nuke people. And that sort of slipped through the net there. So coming back to, are we going to die? That's where I'm a little bit worried.
And we haven't even really talked about the WikiLeaks emails and Putin's kind of
hacks
and what happens if Putin takes over Europe and Trump doesn't like NATO, and I'm going to get a drink.
I think it's safe to say we don't know what's going to happen. The next 4 years are going to be, as they say, interesting times. And we'll be here every week, keeping you up to date with it.
We'll give you more tip-top political predictions.
Actually, the worst come to the worst, tips on how to survive in the nuclear wasteland.
We'll be joining you from our nuclear bunker next week. If nuclear war doesn't happen, please do subscribe to our podcast. You can leave us a review on iTunes. That does help new people discover the show. It'd be nice to get to, you know, 1,000 downloads a month before nuclear Armageddon sets in.
Yeah, it would be quite nice.
Mm. We'll be back next week, hopefully.
It's all right, guys. He doesn't get the nuclear launch codes till January.
Till January. So we'll definitely be here next week. Absolutely fine. Thank you for joining us. Speak to you then.
Bye.
Jeb Bush set out last year, apparently with a reputed $100 million war chest. And you think, Jeb Bush should just have bought an island and
declared himself king.
Just gone there with a lot of cocaine and hookers or something. And he'd have had a much better...
No, I'm pretty sure that's his cousin Billy Bush.
Yes, that's true. But
that's enough locker room banter, guys.